Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in!
How have you been?
The bottom of my driveway is covered in about an inch thick of ice that just melts and refreezes every single day. I'm struggling to get down my driveway to get my mail.
Oh no.
Right now, since it's a little warmer, just all of it's melted right now. So it's water. And I'm really not looking forward to getting my mail in that later because my pants are gonna get wet. Like, they're gonna get wet. I have to accept my fate. I don't really know what else to do about that. Except, I'd, like, take a shovel and shovel the water into the drain. But yeah, that's silly. I would look so silly doing that. Just in the middle of the road with a shovel.
Maybe you could use a mop. I don't know.
Look at me just mopping the street water.
I would love that. That's so fun, though. I don't know what your neighbors might think about you, but it could be a smart move, actually.
I don't really care what my neighbors think of me because...
That's the best way to go.
They're also super weird. When all of the snow first snowed, probably around when we recorded the last episode, it was, it snowed overnight. It's about 12:45. I'm getting ready to sleep. And then somewhere off in the distance, I hear this noise. And I think, no way, this has to be an engine or something, because this can't be a snowblower. This can't be a snowblower. Who is awake at almost midnight?
There's no way.
Snow blowing their driveway. I look out my window and lo and behold, my neighbor, I see the light from the snowblower at almost midnight.
Oh, no. Is that the guy who also always paints his house?
No, that's my other neighbor that paints the house every other year. They're a whole different story. I took a picture of my snowblowing neighbor in the middle of the night just through my window because nobody would have believed me. No one would have believed me if I told that story and didn't have proof.
This is too wild.
And then 7:45 the next morning, he's at it again.
Like, the morning thing kind of makes sense to me. But, like, why would you get up in the middle of the night if you're gonna do it again in the morning anyway?
I don't know.
I would never dare to be that loud in the middle of a weekday night. But some, like, especially older people are so confident in, like, whatever they're doing. I don't think this guy had, like, a single thought.
No.
Maybe this could be, like, a little loud for someone who has to go to work tomorrow morning.
Just another day on this street, honestly. So, to answer your question, no, if I was mopping water in the middle of the street, I don't think anyone would think twice about it. And if they did, that's some gall.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Please, won't you be my neighbor?
So I went and saw a Beatles musical. It's been almost 2 weeks and it was quite fun, actually. It was like a couple of guys performing this. I think I told you afterwards, it was like a little dystopian because besides the guy who was Paul McCartney, who was like maybe 40, everyone else was like 60 at least. And they started with the Beatles in Hamburg and everyone's 17. I was like, that's like a bold casting choice, but okay. But I have to give it to them. They sounded incredible. The way that they were able to mimic the voices was really, really impressive. But it got me thinking, sometimes because we talk so much about the women of the 60s and 70s, I'm like, there is so much representation. There are so many more people are doing it. And then during this entire musical, not a single woman was part of it. They only like mentioned Linda when they talked about how Paul wanted her father to manage the Beatles and then how Yoko broke up the Beatles. Then I went on and like talked about it in my stories, and then several men got back at me and they were like, why should they include like someone like Patty Boyd? She wasn't important. And then I was like, well, okay, I get it. You don't have to feature their wives. I get it. You could leave that out. Mm-hmm. But at a point where you're having someone portray Neil Aspinall, you could have mentioned at least someone like Frida Kelly or Chris O'Dell.
And let's be real, at least one scene where Yoko is just in the studio unexplained, that would be pretty important to the plot. She doesn't have to, you know, be eating George's digestive biscuits or sitting on an amp, but she can be there.
I kind of have to give it to them because it was only 2 hours long and they just went through the entire Beatles history in 2 hours. So it was very condensed.
Very condensed.
But like, they mentioned so many other random people and like random people who worked in the studio and this guy and that guy. However, today we are not going to talk about those Fab Four. We are going to talk about the other Fab Four.
Yes, this week is a first for the Dolls Pod. I floated this idea a couple months ago and I'm glad you said, yeah, go for it, because this is a perfect opportunity. For the first time on the podcast, we are featuring a group, a whole band. We are covering the lives of Britain's first all-female rock group, the Liverbirds. Yes, Liverbirds, as in live music. I made that mistake too at first. This episode is based on The Other Fab Four, a memoir by bassist Mary McGlory and drummer Sylvia Saunders. Not unlike the hosts of this show alternate writing episodes, Mary and Sylvia alternate writing chapters of the book. It's the midpoint between a memoir and an oral history. You're always getting a fresh perspective on some of the same things that happen. The themes are evergreen. I would recommend this book to any girl in a band or any girl who wants to be in a band. I'd like to quickly thank my buddy Mark for this week's episode. Over the summer, he received an advance copy of this book and he reviewed it on his TikTok. I never would have known about this group if not for him. I also would not have known how to pronounce Liverbirds. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much. Mary McGlory was born on February 2nd, 1964, to parents Joseph McGlory and Maggie Dunn. The McGlorys lived in abject poverty, as many Liverpoolians did after the war. It was the most bombed city aside from London, leaving 70,000 homeless. Children played amongst the ruins of bombed buildings. Mary and her family lived with Maggie's parents and uncle. All they had was a small fireplace in the living room to heat the apartment and dry their laundry. It was so cold in the winter, icicles formed inside the windows. Even after the McGlorys got a house of their own, Mary had to share a bed with her siblings. She didn't immediately want to be a musician. Having come from a family of devout Catholics, she really wanted to be a nun. Mary didn't discover her love of music until she was 12. She organized a concert for herself and the other girls on a bus trip to the country. Of course, no one could play any instrument, so they just sang along to the record player. Mary's song of choice was the Kay Sisters' Paper Roses. Paper roses, like your imitation love for me. I realize the way your eyes deceive me with tender looks that I mistook for love. Paper roses. Her rendition was met with applause, something she wasn't used to at all. She realized she wanted more of that, and as soon as she could possibly get it. Because Mary was so busy helping her mom raise her brothers and sisters, she fell behind in school. At 15, she dropped out to be a bookkeeper in a factory. Quote, I assumed I was destined to stay in Liverpool, and one day I might be lucky and find the right husband and have as many kids as my mom. Little did she know where her journey would take her. One day, one of her friends suggested they go see this new band at the Cavern Club. They sounded great, and they looked great too. I was 16 years old. I had never been to a concert or a dance before, Mary told the New York Times. It was so hot in there, it seemed as though the sweat was running down the walls. That band was the Beatles in 1962, right after they'd released Love Me Do. At this fateful gig, they debuted their next big hit, Please Please Me. Something about the Beatles writing their own material inspired Mary. She wanted to bring people the same joy the Fab Four brought her. She talked her cousin Rita and two friends into forming their first band, the Squaws. Sylvia Saunders was born on October 31st, 1946, as the youngest of three siblings. Her parents, Christopher and Gertie, didn't have much money either. No one did. Gertie worked odd jobs to get by, as a laundress in a fish and chip shop, a power plant, a flour mill, scrubbing doorsteps, and cleaning telephone booths. Though she was rarely around and tough to talk to, Sylvia was inspired by her mom's industrious nature. She was willing to do anything to keep her family afloat, even if it meant sacrificing quality time with her children. Chris was around much more, tending to the family's small garden and their chickens. There was never a dull moment on the Saunders farm. Her brother Chris was a notorious troublemaker. He somehow wound up with a pet monkey. That is wild. That makes me think of the guy Uschi Obermeier ended up marrying. Remember that when she first heard about him, everyone said that he had a monkey too, but she did not get along with the monkey, so they ended up getting rid of him.
I forgot. The monkey story in the book isn't explained much past that. As far as Sylvia knows, some lady just approached her brother like, hey, do you want a pet monkey? And he was like, sure, why not? And then this lady just hands him the monkey.
What? Where did she have the monkey from?
I don't know. His nickname in town was Monkey Guy. Like Monkey Man or something, because he just had this monkey around.
That is so wild. I love that. I love that they were living this regular farm life, but her brother just randomly had a monkey. Sylvia was trouble in school too. To channel her energy, her parents put her in sports, swimming lessons, and acting classes. Even then, it still wasn't enough to get that energy out. Sylvia got her first taste of freedom when her parents bought a van to vacation with. She couldn't get enough of the excitement travel brought. When Chris became a hairdresser and started entering competitions, Sylvia was his model. She loved the attention. Showing up with a different hairstyle every week brought, especially from the boys. Quote, I was starting to discover freedom outside the regimen confines of school. Being a teenager in the early 1960s meant a world of fun and hedonism, with the music right at the center. At 15, she too dropped out of school. Say it's gonna die, but honey, be let's face it.
So we're seeing a couple themes pop up here already. The backdrop of post-war Britain, in which nobody has very much of anything besides a pet monkey here and there. And these two girls living really strict lives, wanting to break out of that. Mary was very Catholic, and Sylvia went to, I think Sylvia was Protestant, but her schooling was very regimented, very strict, very old school, mm-hmm. like you get rapped on the knuckles if you misbehave.
Oh, wow.
We have two girls wanting to break out.
Mm.
This third, our third character, is very much breaking out.
Yes.
Sylvia met Valerie Gell through the Girl Scouts. It was at a costume party where the girls were supposed to dress as beatniks to express their inner artist or something. Val didn't get the memo. She dressed as a zombie. Face paint and all.
I love this.
Such like regular girl experiences too.
Yes, this is such a universal thing.
Val was only a year older than Sylvia, a born leader and outsider. Born August 15th, 1945, Val was the only child of parents Tom and Joyce, a dock worker and factory worker. Joyce was strict, image conscious, and very religious. She wanted to come off as upper class, even at the expense of her relationship with her own daughter. Val wasn't about to be inauthentic. She rebelled however she could, dropping out of school at 15, drinking alcohol, going out to the clubs at night, or befriending her openly gay co-workers when being gay was still illegal in Britain. It wasn't long before Val roped her new friend Sylvia into her adventures. Their spot wasn't the cavern, it was the Jive Hive. Mark Peters and the Silhouettes were Sylvia's favorite band she saw there. quote, I used to watch their every move thinking that Mark Peters was lovely, but I didn't just want him. I wanted to be him, thinking to myself, I could do a bit of this, get up on that stage. Val also rebelled against her mother by making music. When Sylvia saw her playing Apache by the Shadows on guitar, she wanted to try for herself. When she tried to make a chord, her hands were too small. She decided to play the drums instead. Never mind that they had no singer, no bassist, and no name, they were going to form a band. One day, Val bought a copy of Mercy Beat. The squaws immediately caught her eye. Their press photos were quite arresting. Mary and the girls wore suede waistcoats and feathers in their hair. Mary acknowledged that this would never fly nowadays, stating their Native American gimmick had, quote, a nasty taste of cultural misappropriation. They were the only female group in town, and their contact info was printed in the magazine. Val and Sylvia took themselves right to Mary's doorstep to ask for help.
Lucky for them, the squaws had just broken up, kind of. They were never a band in the first place. Though they'd had articles written about them, they never played a single gig. They couldn't even play their instruments. They mostly used their gear to get into the Cavern Club for free. That's such a great idea to do it.
It works. It works. Yeah. You have gear with you. They just assume you're in a band and you can get in.
I love how confident they were.
Yes.
What started as Val and Sylvia coming to Mary for help became Val teaching Mary how to play. Rita didn't want to actually be in a band, so she left, but not before suggesting a new name. The Squaws was a stupid name, she declared. The Liverbirds would be much better. The Liverbirds are real. They're two giant bronze birds on the roof of the Royal Liver Building. The name would tell the world the band was from Liverpool, a fashionable place since the Beatles got big, and that they were all girls. When Rita left, Mary switched to bass. Her other cousin Sheila filled in on guitar, and the Liverbirds' name stuck. Once the girls thought they were ready to gig, they turned up expectantly at the Cavern Club. Mary's bringing gear to get in for free trick didn't work this time. Cavern MC Bob Wooler turned them away from the stage. Instead, he brought them backstage to meet the Beatles. Upon entering the dressing room, the girls stumbled upon a half-naked Paul McCartney and John Lennon. Like Frida Kelly, Mary also emphasized how hot and smelly the cavern was. The guys were changing out of the clothes they sweat through. Paul was sweet to the girls, introducing himself and asking them if they were all right. Apart from their own brothers, the girls had never seen a guy in his underwear before. They completely froze up. But John wasn't as kind. When Bob introduced the Liverbirds as a group, John plainly said, "Girls don't play guitar." They left the cavern in a huff. Unbelievable, they thought. Though it stung in the moment, Sylvia doesn't think John was being serious. Quote, although he often made sardonic comments, he was also sensitive and intelligent, an artist who regretted his disdainful treatment of women. It's clear his feelings about women evolved, but we also wonder if what he said that day in the cavern dressing room was meant to test us, provoke us into making success of the band. If so, it certainly worked. Determined to prove a Beatle wrong, the Liverbirds started playing shows. Thanks to Mary's pastor, they landed their first gig at a senior center. They only knew three songs: Apache, the Steptoe and Son theme song, and Hava Nagila. The little old ladies clapped and cheered. The girls joked it was because they'd lost their hearing aids. Eventually, Bob allowed them to play the cavern. Despite still not having a singer, they were received well. Girls would crowd in front of the stage, screaming and making up chants. They were proud that girls from their hometown could be on stage like that. The Liverbirds would play there six more times. An article in Mersey Beat put them in contact with their first manager and their first singer, Irene. Neither worked out in the long run. It turned out this manager was secretly pocketing their money. Luckily, they were able to fire him. Meanwhile, their singer was more interested in being a solo act. Before she left, the Liverbirds landed a gig with soon-to-be mega stars, the Rolling Stones. They'd only just released I Wanna Be Your Man.
I wanna be your lover, baby. I wanna
Ryan was soft-spoken and sweet, and Mick had lots of questions. They'd never met an all-girl group before. When Mary's string broke during the Liverbird set, she panicked and started crying. Bill Wyman rushed in to help, lending her his bass and replacing her broken string for her. Altogether, the guys were far from the bad boy image Andrew Oldham orchestrated. Once the Liverbird saw the Stones play, they realized they wanted to go in a more blues and rock and roll direction. Mary said, quote, "We didn't know who wrote these songs or how we were going to do it, but it became our secret ambition." The Liverbirds' other great ambition was to play in Hamburg. They knew the Beatles found great success there. Other British bands had too. The girls longed to have their own adventures in Germany. As if by a miracle, the Liverbirds got their chance. Bill Harry, creator of Mercy Beat, tipped them off to an agent auditioning groups for Hamburg.
Henry Henrod was Liverpool's premier talent agent. He'd been in the business since the 50s, working with rock managers Mickey Most and Don Arden. As Arden's assistant, he brought American heavyweights like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis to Britain for the first time. By 1963, he was bringing German groups out to Liverpool. He also worked for... Could you help me with the pronunciation of this last name, please?
It's Manfred Weisleder.
Manfred Weisleder, manager of the Star Club.
That was really good.
Yay! German audiences had an appetite for Liverpool groups, as did the club managers. There were plenty to choose from, as many as 500 bands at a time. It seemed everyone wanted to be in a group. Post-war Britain was so dark and gloomy for so long, it's no wonder youth culture popped off in the 60s. It was a reflection of these kids' city healing. Bombed buildings were rebuilt, and the economy wasn't quite so dire anymore, so they could afford to buy instruments. Liverpool bands were eager to play, and cheaper to hire than those from London. After a successful audition with Henry, the Liverbirds were on track to be one of those bands. There were just a few issues to work out first. They had no manager, Sylvia was still underage, Sheila and their replacement singer had one foot out the door. The final piece of the Liverbirds fell into place when they played with the Kinks. This wasn't their only meeting, they'd wound up at the same studio once. The Kinks were recording their next single, or were supposed to. It only took a minute, but while their van was parked outside, the guys' gear was stolen. The Liverbirds lent them theirs for the session, ending the day with a raucous jam with the Rolling Stones. What was that single?
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
The Kinks' first big hit, You Really Got Me.
That's such a good song.
Yes. I'll have to go back and see if those guitar tones sound different.
I was just thinking about that, but I couldn't hear it different.
I'm thinking of All Day and All of the Night. I'm trying to remember what that guitar sounded like and if they sound too different. I'll just edit it in and post. At this gig, singer Ray Davies had eyes for Fierce and Pretty Val. As for Sheila, he quite matter-of-factly said, "It's not going to work out. She's gotta go." He recommended a girl he'd literally just met. She'd tagged along with the Kinks from the Cavern Club and was waiting in the van to get a ride back. The Liverbirds all clambered into this little van with all four Kinks, their manager, and future lead singer Pam Birch. With her blonde hair piled high on her head and Chelsea boots boosting her height, she commanded attention without having to try. Born August 9th, 1944, Pam was the oldest of the Liverbirds. The Birches were a musical family. Her younger sister sang, and her parents actually met while busking down on Broadway. She'd left school at 16 to become a typist, and had just left a long-term relationship with her first boyfriend. He was in school, She was working. He wanted to settle down, get married, and have kids, while she wanted to become a musician. The girls hit it off with Pam immediately. She was confident, driven, knew her stuff about rock and roll, and had great style. She was already a working musician, playing songs by Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. Most importantly, Pam could play. She wanted to do more R&B and blues music. This worked out perfectly. The Liverbirds let Pam right into the group, working rock numbers like Roadrunner and Diddly Daddy into their set. In turn, Pam encouraged Val to start singing. It wasn't long before the two were singing harmony. Val worked out the arrangements, making space for solos, or fiddly bits, as the girls called them. It was clear the Liverbirds were improving. But they still didn't have a manager. The Kinks introduced the girls to Larry Page. It didn't work out. They had a brush with Jimmy Seville. Thankfully, the girls avoided him. Then they bumped into Brian Epstein at a coffee shop in London. He even called them, saying he was interested in taking them on, but they turned him down. In May of 1964, after 7 long months, Sylvia's paperwork was finally approved. Their gig at the Star Club was officially moving forward. The girls wore stockings and dresses under their coats in a new set of press photos, except for Pam. She turned up in baggy jeans and her signature fisherman's cap. Henry booked them at the Star every Saturday night for 6 weeks at £30 a week. It was more than all of the girls made at their day jobs combined. It was an offer they couldn't refuse. Instead of congratulating them, Brian gave a stark warning. "I know, Manfred. If you go to the Star Club, you'll never come back."
Hi, this is Emma quickly checking in. So there was an issue with my audio. I re-recorded pretty much all of my parts, but the little conversations that Abby and I had in between, I just wanted to keep in. So I am very, very sorry that the audio quality isn't as good in those clips, and I really hope you can bear with us through this. The Star Club was unlike anything the sheltered girls had seen before. Sylvia described arriving for the first time and getting the shock of her life. "It wasn't until we walked around the corner that we saw all the red lights. The club was surrounded by porn parlors, striptease clubs, and brothels. We thought, oh my god, what if our parents see this?" For 4 girls on their own for the first time, it was a lot to take in. There were more surprises in store when they entered the club. Like the cavern, the Star Club stunk. All the irrigation systems in Hamburg were destroyed in the war. It took decades to rebuild. The club was much bigger than it looked from the outside. The front was small, but a crowd of 2,000 people could fit inside. The lights hung by chains from the ceiling. If the barmaids liked the band, they'd swing the lights. If not, that band was probably going to get fired. As the girls made their way to the dressing room, people crowded around them. The banners outside had hyped the Liverbirds up for over a month. People couldn't believe they were actually real. Mary explained, "There certainly was no expectation that girls could play music in bands. At the very least, we could carve a place on the pop scene as a singer in a pretty dress. There were no pretty dresses to be found here, though. Tomboy Pam forbade them." The Liverbirds had a lot of first experiences that night. Their first gig at the Star Club, that went very well. Then their first raid at said Star Club. German authorities were very strict about alcohol at clubs and curfew. Since Sylvia was still 17, she was escorted home until the cops left. Then she'd sneak right back in. She had to do this every night until she turned 18. And the Liverbirds met their first queer fans. A small group of lesbians were anxiously awaiting the band's arrival since they were announced. They welcomed the girls with champagne. When one of the barmen told the girls this group of fans were lesbians, Mary naively asked, "Oh, where's that?"
That's so sweet.
We all have that one friend, yeah. Right? The one sheltered friend in your group. Some of us may have even been that sheltered kid. It was me.
I was just thinking that would have been me. I had no idea what was going on.
Live at Bird's gig became something of a haven for queer women. There weren't many women in the Hamburg music scene at all at the time. They clung on to anyone they could.
And this is why representation is so important.
Yes.
The Star Club turned out to be great fun. Finally, they had a stage big enough for an act. Roadrunner featured Mary and Pam running around the stage like hooligans. For money, that's what I want, they turned their back to the audience and wiggled their behinds as the audience threw loose change at the stage. It was truly a sight to see. Val in the middle with tiny Mary on one side and tall Pam on the other. Oh, you can keep them for the better. Though the audience was demanding, the Liverbirds had a healthy amount of girlish fun. They got to share the bill with some wild acts like Screaming Lord Such and the Savages. They were even drawing bigger crowds than the Beatles did. And they finally found a manager, Manfred Weisleder. Not only that, but he signed them to his brand new label, Star Club Records. It boasted successful Star Club acts like The Rattles and Lee Curtis and the All-Stars, and licensed Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis singles for German releases. In December, the Liverbirds headed to Munich to make their first album. It was produced by Hans Beierlein, who'd brought François Hardy and Petula Clark to Germany. Manfred titled the album Star Club Show 4 because it was the fourth album the label released. Very creative. The Liverbirds' debut single was a cover of Smokey Robinson's Shop Around, backed with one of Pam's original songs, It's Gotta Be You. Though it wasn't a big hit, there was a record store next door to the club. It got plenty of foot traffic from the patrons and sold a good amount of Liverbirds' music. Their next single, a cover of Bo Diddley's Diddley Daddy, performed much better. It was a top 5 hit in Germany. The band soon settled into a routine. Wake up around noon, get lunch at a cheap diner, have a short day out before dinner at 5. Then it was off to the Star Club to work from 8:30 at night to 3 or 4 in the morning. It was great fun for a group of single girls in the 60s, a relatively new demographic at the time. Every night had a different energy, Sylvia remembered. 50 Russian sailors might come pouring in at 8, and an hour later the crowd would be full of teenage hipsters. The place was always heaving and crowded backstage with musicians. We weren't competitive with each other. If somebody broke a string, there would always be someone to help out. The Liverbirds soon learned that Brian was right. Signing with Manfred meant they wouldn't go back home to England anytime soon. 6 weeks at the club turned into 6 months, and 6 months turned into 3 years. Hamburg would be the Liverbirds' home for the rest of their career. With an act like theirs, it wasn't long before the Liverbirds took Germany by storm.
You made a whole YouTube video about sort of the advent of the single girl lifestyle in the 60s.
That's really interesting because I stumbled upon that in an article from the 60s that was kind of like discussing how this was so new. And when researching this, it dawned on me that in the 50s and early 60s, it was very much expected of a woman to just marry as soon as you leave the house. And it was like the only way to leave the house for a long time. And in the 60s, a lot of young girls were starting to get jobs and not marry right away. And it was the first time that young girls would have their own place, or maybe a couple of girls would live together. Something that is so, it seems so normal nowadays, but it was so new and fun back then.
In my vintage magazine collection, I'll flip through and right next to ads, you know, featuring class rings for your high school graduation, there's like, have your wedding registry with JCPenney. And then a page later is prom dresses. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yes, it was all, it was so normal for people to like live at home until you're 19, 20, and then get married, move out, never be on your own.
Or marry your high school boyfriend right after graduation, which to me sounds terrifying.
That is so wildly early. If we would have done that, you and I would be married almost 10 years by now. Could you imagine? That is insane.
It is ironic that you made the single girl video because for our current time, you got married and started a family very young, but yeah. in the 60s, you would have been like a normal age to start that stage in your life, yes. and I would be like an old spinster.
No.
I remember the first time that I thought about that was when I read about Cynthia Lennon having her first child with John, or her only child was John, so early on. I remember back then it baffled me in that biography how they were like, okay, this is kind of like not too good because they aren't married, but no one talked about the fact that they were like 20 because that was just very normal. Yep. It was normal to just get married at 20 and then that's it.
We're going to come back to this later in the story as well.
Yes.
In June, the Liverbirds landed the gig of a lifetime, opening for Chuck Berry. This would be huge. They'd be playing for 11,000 people, the biggest crowd they'd ever played for. They'd have to fly to Berlin for this show. None of the girls had ever been on an airplane before. They took a train after a boat to get to Hamburg, I think. And it wasn't a pleasant flight. They were crammed into the tiny plane with four other groups, and it was a very bumpy ride. Once the plane landed, the Liverbirds were whisked away to the
Deutschlandhalle.
The Deutschlandhalle.
That's good.
On the way to the gig, Manfred said they couldn't play any Chuck Berry songs. The girls panicked. Chuck's material was the foundation of their sets. How could they play 20 minutes without any of his songs? Despite the Deutschlandhalle's poor acoustics, the Liverbirds pushed through. Thinking they were safe, they rushed to the bar for a drink after their set. I would need a drink after that stressful of a situation, too.
Yes.
They didn't know that Chuck was running late. After no more than a sip, a voice came on the PA calling the Liverbirds back to the stage. They panicked again. They really couldn't play another 20 minutes. Returning to a cheering crowd sparked something in Val. Blow it. We're doing Roll Over Beethoven. Mary protests. What? We can't do that. Val counts them in anyway, launching the band into one of Chuck's biggest hits. The crowd went wild. Hearing another band playing one of his songs must have zapped Chuck's fashionable lateness. He quickly appeared at the side of the stage, incensed. He was yelling so much he went blue in the face. But the girls didn't care. When the song was over, Chuck's manager joined the fray. He stormed the stage and tried to pull Val away from the mic. "Fuck off," she shouted, and counted the girls in for Johnny B. Good. When the girls got back to their hotel room, they found a message from Manfred saying he'd like to see them in the morning. They feared the worst. Surely they'd get fired for pissing off one of the founding fathers of rock and roll. But it was quite the opposite. Over breakfast, Manfred told the girls that Chuck's manager wanted to bring them to America. But there was a catch. They'd be booked in a club in Vegas and would be performing topless. What a disappointment. Can you imagine me playing the drums topless? Sylvia said in an interview with Emily Webb, they'd be flying all over the place. Though playing in America was everything the girls had been working for, they weren't about to compromise their values and be a gimmick. The Liverbirds declined, opting to stay in Germany. Little did they know, the topless performance detail was something Manfred snuck in himself. He didn't want to lose his club star act, so he sabotaged their would-be trip to the States. Don't worry, the Liverbirds did eventually make it to America to see Benny King, but still, that is so lame of him.
It is. That's not fair at all. I get it from his perspective, but he should have given them the opportunity. I don't understand how this wasn't in his like best interest either, because yes, he ran the Star Club, but then also he was their manager. Like, it would have been great for him if they got more fans in the States.
The Liverbirds were on his label. Like, if they go and sell more music in America, he benefits. I don't know.
That's just a broken ego or something.
Yep. Throughout their memoir, Mary and Sylvia describe befriending the German artists orbiting the Star Club, like Klaus Voormann, Astrid Kircher, and garage band The Rattles. Though their parents and even some peers were still hostile towards Germans after the war, the Liverbirds were open-minded. Liverpool and Hamburg were two of the worst bombed cities in the war. In time, natives found their experiences were a lot more alike than different. Quote, "Every night in the Star Club, 2,000 German fans and British musicians on stage built a bridge without anyone realizing what was going on. In that sense, our music was part of healing rifts that went deep into society. It was a whole generation feeling the healing power of music." In due time, the girls had enough money to visit home 3 times a year. Mary took great pride in being able to support her family. But Hamburg was now home. By 1965, they were thoroughly settled. They made the Star Club their home base, touring around Germany and Austria. They had boyfriends, if only to get rides in their nice cars. Sylvia met her future husband, John, while Mary met a cute German guy named Frank. Val was swept off her feet by an eccentric fashion student named Stefan. He styled the Liverbirds. Meanwhile, Pam was seeing Lee Curtis, even though he was married. She wrote, "Leave all your loves in the past," about him. They had friends, favorite restaurants, and a good relationship with Manfred. The Liverbirds had their fair share of problems with men. Sylvia lost her virginity to Klaus Voormann. In hindsight, she suspects him and his buddies made a bet to see who could deflower a Liverbird first. Keith Richards called them, quote, "real slags" in a Stones biography. Mary doesn't know where the disconnect was because the Stones were so nice to them when they first met. They were harassed by a few guys they played with. One drew a penis on the wall of the dressing room with a rude message. But there was always someone to look out for the girls, whether it was Manfred, their touring manager Oscar, or each other. The Star Club was an ecosystem fueled by women. Groupies hung around outside. The barmaids looked out for each other and the young female patrons. The stage manager looked after the band, scheduling from 6 at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. Since the Star Club was in the red light district, sex workers came to the club. The ladies looked after British bands at the other clubs. If they met some guys cheated out of their night's pay, they'd cover a meal. If a drunk guy was bothering the Liverbirds, sex workers would get their bodyguards or the doorman to help. Mary was still very Catholic. She went to church every week. This opened her eyes to different ways of living. She realized you're not a bad person if you have sex before marriage. Quote, "As I got to know them, I began to understand their lifestyle and see them as people rather than just being sinners or fallen women. Everyone wanted the same things in the end, to be happy and to get by."
Stephen tipped the girls off to a brand new TV show. The producers hoped to attract a strong teen audience by featuring the hottest acts around. Think of it as the grandfather to MTV. The Liverbirds threw their heads in the ring. To their shock, they were chosen as the first musical guests alongside the Yankees and John O'Hara and his Playboys. The Liverbirds played 3 songs. Their single, Diddly Daddy, their new signature song, The Marathon's Peanut Butter, and an original song, Why Do You Hang Around Me, another song Pam wrote about Lee. The audience didn't really know what to do during the slower Why Do You Hang Around Me, but they perked right up for Diddly Daddy and Peanut Butter. This was similar to how the Star Club audiences acted. The patrons weren't much for ballads, but they couldn't get enough of rock and roll. After its series premiere, Beat Club went on to be a huge success. It featured historic bands like Cream, The Who, The Kinks, The Birds, Santana, and Deep Purple. It featured Star Club bands and other German groups like Amon Jewel. In 1972, it aired The Grateful Dead's final film set with Pigpen McKernan. Beat Club also platformed Fanny, the first all-female rock group, to get a major record deal. In 1966, the Liverbirds recorded their second album, More of the Liverbirds. They were successful enough to experiment with new looks and cutting-edge instruments. Pam got a hold of a Tuban guitar. Kraftwerk would use one in the 70s.
That band name sounds so much better in German.
But Kraftwerk, that's like a real thing. It's like a power plant. Is that what you say?
A power plant.
Yeah, it's like the place where you make power.
It's not just a band
name. No, that's what
it is. It's an actual German word. Yes. I feel silly now.
No, you're all good.
They expanded their tours through Europe and played at stadiums, including the Waldbühne in Berlin, the same venue where the Rolling Stones fans broke out in a riot. The Liverbirds even had a fan club. 1967 was the summer of love. Drugs became mainstream, the portal to a new world. The Beatles experimented with LSD while recording Revolver and Sgt. Pepper. The Stones were busted for Procession for the first time, dragging out the production of their Satanic Majesty request. It was the year Brian Jones overindulged and his downward spiral began. Though marijuana was popularized in Britain and America through 65 and 66, it never took off in the Hamburg scene. Musicians preferred uppers so they could last their hour-long sets. Sylvia took pills until John told her to stop. Mary didn't like drugs at all. She wanted to keep her wits about her. Nevertheless, she started carrying around a black doctor's bag with rolling papers and weed. She was great at rolling joints. That skill came in handy one night in March when Jimi Hendrix played at the Star Club. Quote, "With his arrival, we sensed that music was changing, moving from beat pop to psychedelic sounds and longer, more complicated guitar solos." Jimmy arrived in style. Abby plugged Jimmy's Star Club dates and managed to find photos of him from that night, wearing the exact outfit Mary described, a patterned silk shirt and red velvet trousers.
This is such a classic Jimmy look.
Yeah. What was it that he met the plaster casters and it was like this orange velvet suit?
Yes.
He was such a well-dressed guy.
Yes, and we also saw that clip when he met Ushi. He was also dressed so, so cool.
Yeah, with the like long scarf. Yes. And the hat. You always think of the hat.
Always such
Jimmy.
A good-dressed man. Yes.
The Liverbirds were mesmerized by Jimmy as he tore through Foxy Lady, Hey Joe, and Wild Thing. After the show, the girls went to the dressing room to meet him. Jimmy was there, flocked by other musicians, fans, and of course girls. He instantly noticed the all-girl group arrive. "Which one of you is Mary?" he asked to no one in particular. Mary sheepishly identified herself. "I've been waiting for you," Jimmy said. "I've been told you make the best joints in Hamburg." She wrote one for Jimmy and he really liked it. What a welcome gift. More than just the music was changing in 67. Mary and Sylvia moved in with their boyfriends, and Pam got an apartment of her own for Lee to crash out. One day, he left to visit his wife and kids back in England and never returned to Hamburg. Pam was devastated by the breakup. The night after Stephen got his driver license, he was in a serious accident. It left him paralyzed from the waist down. Val felt terribly guilty, as he was on the way to propose to her when he crashed. She married him and soon made the tough decision to leave the band. She'd be his caretaker for the rest of his life. Then in summer of 1967, Sylvia discovered she was pregnant. Fearing the side effects, she'd recently gone off the pill. Quote, "Being pregnant out of wedlock mattered in those days. Young, unmarried mothers were shipped off and sent away to Catholic orphanages, forced to give away their babies for adoption, and, in so doing, lose a part of themselves." Though the Summer of Love ushered in progressive movements like environmentalism and civil rights, feminism took its sweet time to catch up. It would be two more years until Joan Baez took the Woodstock stage while pregnant. Being a mother and working musician at the same time just wasn't possible. On top of that, it was a difficult pregnancy. When Sylvia saw a doctor, he urged her to quit the band to rest. She elected to marry her boyfriend John and quit the Liverbirds to raise their child.
Pam and Mary continued on with the band. They found temporary members and, thanks to a deal with Yamaha, played in Japan for 6 weeks in 1968. They were met with a burst of Liverbird mania. They played all the major cities, did countless TV appearances and interviews, and received beautiful kimonos as welcome gifts. The Japanese loved American rock and roll and English beat music. Quote, they absolutely loved us. When we got off the plane, loads and loads of people would bring me bunches of flowers and a lot of press and interviews going on. People with banners with We Love the Liverbirds, Mary described to the BBC. But it just wasn't the same without Val and Sylvia. In 1968, after honoring their last few obligations in Germany, the Liverbirds broke up. Mary moved to England with Frank, officially splitting the former Liverbirds between two countries. 14 months later, the Star Club closed its doors. The building burned down in 1987. You've been to the site where the Star Club used to be, yes?
Yes. And they even put up, it has to be a replica sign, but they have that kind of like sign that is so iconic, it's still up or it's up again. But it's still kind of like the same as they described. It's still in the red light district. That's still kind of like the same, I want to say. It's this part of Hamburg where I think it came because this is where the sailors would come in and just spend their days.
Yeah.
And there are still ships coming in, but it's not as big anymore. But now it's more of like, I don't want to say a tourist attraction, but to some degree, it definitely is. It's like the biggest red light district in Germany, I think. And so a lot of people like to go there. There's even a street there where women aren't allowed to step in.
Why? What is it?
It's like there are brothels in that street and it's very common. I don't know what it's like in the US, but it's very common here for these kind of like clubs to just have naked women in the windows. And that part of the street is kind of like locked away. And you're not allowed to go in there if you're a woman or if you're under 18.
It's interesting to know that the windows are still there because in the book, I think it was Sylvia, she befriended a sex worker who would come to the Star Club. And she would stand in one of these windows. And one time she was like, Sylvia, go stand in the window for a minute. It would be funny. So she stands there fully clothed just in the window.
That's a fun idea.
And all these guys were flocking around her because she was the only one with clothes on. So they were like pointing, like, what is she doing?
That's so cool, though. I like that.
I wish I could have included more like little stories from this book because there are so many local characters like the sex worker dominatrix and the other bands that they played with. And there's more about Klaus and Astrid.
Yeah.
I guess Astrid styled them for a while. Just there's
so cool.
Hamburg had a lot of personality.
Yes. A lot of eccentric people.
The Liverbirds have reunited a few times, even enjoying a full band set at the club they called home for so long. Pam stayed in the music industry, first working for a record label, then as a DJ. She struggled to cope with the band's breakup, self-medicating with alcohol and cocaine. She passed away at 65 of lung cancer. Sylvia was by her side for her final days. Having become a widow at age 49, Val struggled with alcoholism. Sylvia got her out of a bad situation, moving Val back to Hamburg. Upon embarking on a journey of self-discovery, she realized she was a lesbian. After a brief relationship with a woman she met at a reunion, Val met her partner, Susan. They were adorable together. They liked the same things, had the same haircut, shared clothes, and were both living sober. They'd spend the rest of their lives together. Mary and Sylvia are still alive today, carrying on the Liverbirds' legacy. Mary moved back to Germany with her songwriter husband, Frank. They had a family of their own and ran a publishing company until Frank's passing. Sylvia and John moved to Spain for a time to open their own bars and restaurants. They had two sons and provided a place for Pam to stay when she needed one. John passed away the same month as Frank. Looking at the Liverbird story, it's hard not to dwell on all of the what-ifs. What if they'd hired Brian Epstein as their manager? What if they stayed in England instead of going to Hamburg? What if Stefan hadn't gotten in that accident? Would Val had stayed in the band? What if Pam hadn't gotten into drugs? Could Sylvia have been a musician and a mom at the same time? What if they changed with the times instead of sticking to rock and roll? It's hard not to wonder. Mary and Sylvia agreed things happened the way they were meant to happen. If they hadn't been in a band and moved to Germany, they wouldn't have met their husbands, had their kids, had grandkids too. They would have missed out on a lot of amazing life experiences they would have never had otherwise. They wouldn't have paved the way for girls to pick up instruments of their own. Their shows provided a place for society's outsiders to congregate and for people to find common ground. Though Pam and Val didn't get to see how important the band is, their impact isn't forgotten. The New York Times made a short documentary about them in 2019. Just last year, they got their very own musical, aptly titled Girls Don't Play Guitars. There's rumors a film is in the works. We can't wait to see. Being in a band opened these girls' eyes to the world. It made them confident, self-actualized young women. Above all, the Liverbirds taught each other, and us, the power of female friendships. Though the Liverbirds' end was very sudden, there was no big blowout like the Beatles had. These women stayed friends, even after the end. We never ever got as famous as the Beatles, Sylvia said, but we started as friends and we ended as friends. In the end, that's what matters most. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed the story of the Liverbirds, not Liverbirds.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
Per usual, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro tune. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.